to be in a wooded area. They would plant trees on the top of the hangar, maybe artificial trees, but trees that just looked like the surround.
Yeah.
Smoke, yeah, they use an awful lot of smoke. There's no question about that. And they were very skillful in the use of smoke. And, I think, and there isn't really very much I can add to that, but they were outstanding. Now, one other thing perhaps I should mention before we wind up here. I mentioned the last day we were together, the Tiger Force. Tiger Force is force that was being planned and assembled to go out to join the United States in the Pacific Theater. And as early as October, I guess, in 1944, when it was obvious that the defeat of Germany wasn't too far off in the future, planning started in the UK for on the Tiger Force. Tiger Force was both land and air effort on the part of Britain and Canada in support of the United States and other parts of the Commonwealth. And the original planning, as I say, started in October, and it was intensified in the spring of 1945 and went through a number of vicissitudes. We had an officer down there on the planning staff, Frank Miller. He was then an air commander there.
Oh, yeah.
Miller, and if I remember correctly, he was detached from his base. He was doing a job similar to the job that I had in 64 base. He was a base commander, I guess, at 62 or 63, and he was drawn away from that and temporarily assigned to the planning staff in London. And if I remember correctly, there was to be one division of the Canadian Army assigned to this force, and there was to be two groups of Air Force, one centered around Sixth Group and the other built around Five Group. And these were fairly sizable formations. They weren't at all modest in their planning effort. One of the groups, indeed, I think maybe initially there were going to be three groups. There was going to be one RAF group, there was going to be one RCAF group, and there was going to be one so-called Commonwealth group, which would be part UK, but mainly Australia, New Zealand, and so on, to build it up. And they were not only composed of bomber aircraft, but they were to have fighter squadrons to use in support of the bombers and a transport element, two or three squadrons of transports. Added up, that was a big force to add to the already big forces the Americans had out there.
Yeah.
And as time went on, they modified the plans and cut it down to two groups. And then they cut down the number of squadrons in the groups. So ultimately, when the aircraft were flown back to Canada in preparation for the move to the Pacific, I think it wound up with 10 bomber squadrons, and four of which came from my base up there in the northern part of 6th Group. Largely because we were equipped entirely with Canadian-built Lancs, and the idea was that we would send a force out to the Pacific entirely of Canadian-built Lancs. So they were going to add to that nucleus of the four squadrons up there and build it up to 10 squadrons. And indeed, the planning went ahead on this. The war in Europe wound up, and just about almost coincident with this, the squadron started their trek back to Canada in preparation. Some squadrons stayed over there to support the British Army of Occupation, and some squadrons of Bomber Command were disbanded, but 10 went back to to Canada, and they were based in the Maritimes, mainly Nova Scotia, and their work up was to be done in Greenwood and Yarmouth and places like that. And I don't know whether some went to Burt, but Dartmouth and so on. That was the work up area. Now, there's another, I don't know, we've got time, I'll start on this anyway. Another interesting aspect to this. The commander, the designated commander for the force, for the Canadian air element of the force, was Black Mike McEwen. He was extremely anxious to get this assignment. And he lobbied for it a bit. And he'd done a good job, and I guess he was a fairly logical one to pick. But there was a problem involved. There are very few people, and he saw to it that there were very few people, knew that he was suffering quite severely from diabetes. He discovered this just before he was sent over from Canada to join Sixth Group. He must have browbeaten his medical officer. He was stationed in Gander just before he went overseas. He either browbeat his medical officer or he discovered this through a civilian practitioner. I don't remember that part of it. But it didn't become known in the service that he had diabetes. He never would have got overseas had it been known. He took overseas with him the same aide he had in Gander, the same personal staff officer. So he was the one who had the secret. He operated close to Black Mike the whole time there, Sixth Group. And he managed to maintain this secrecy. He had to get insulin. And he had to get insulin through channels other than service channels, because he didn't want the service MOs to know about this.
Right.
So Chess Holmes, his Newfoundland aide, he was a Newfoundlander, managed to get into cahoots with a local doctor up there in the York area and get this supply of insulin. And Chess administered it. And this went on through the whole time Black Mike was over there. I always thought this was, you know, to his credit. He worked very hard and difficult hours at times, and that's hard for a diabetic. And he kept this secret. But, you see, there was going to come a time when he'd get caught out. He could get away with it in the UK. But for some reason or other, he wasn't prepared to admit that he couldn't get away with it in a little island in the Pacific where there were no civilian practitioners and only doctors would be service medicos. And the moment his secret was out, he'd be sent home. Because they wouldn't keep him out there in a place like that. So his aide, Chess Holmes, I'm not just sure why he confided in me, but he did. He when I went down to the Business Six Group shortly after I arrived there, not too long after I arrived, he asked if he could have a chat with me. So we got into huddle privately, and he told me the dilemma he was in and wanted to know what I thought he should do. His boss's heart was set on going out there. It just meant so much to him to take this course out that Holmes knew it just wasn't sensible. So I said, well, there's only one thing that to do. It's unfair to the service. It's unfair to the future commander who's going to have to leave him out there if he goes ahead with this. You've got to... And you're the only person who knows about this. You can't let them know that you've talked to me about it. You've got to get into huddle. I said, is there any other person who does know about it? And he said, yes, there is one person. And he said, that's Doc Hutton. And Doc Hutton was the group senior medical officer on Black Mike's staff. And he was one of these very flexible fellows who was prepared to keep secret away from his medical teams and support his AOC. So I said, well, you and Doc Hutton have got to get into a huddle with the boss and drive it home in no uncertain terms that it's just not on and that it should be done right away because there should be a new commander designate appointed and in touch with the planning that's going on and the preparation for the training of these crews and so on. So they did, and with tremendous reluctance, he finally decided he'd better go down to London and fess up.
Yeah.
And by this time, Bredner had left. Bredner was there after he'd been CIS. He went over as commander-in-chief of RCA overseas headquarters in London. He had just left, and G.O. Johnson was the new commander there. Bredner would have been much more sympathetic, I guess. But Bredner would have taken the right action, mm-hmm. but he wouldn't have been so hard on Black and Leg. G.O. was very, very annoyed when he discovered this. I thought that one should have been prepared to put the annoyance aside and having regard to the very outstanding job mm-hmm. that Black Mike had done, put this down as a mark in his favor, that he was prepared to slog it out through the war years with his handicap and even go out on bombing missions with the boys, with the troops. He didn't go frequently, but he went out on one or two just to show that he was, wanted to see what they were up against. G.O. Johnson, on the other hand, used that as a mark against him and really blasted him out for having done this because it could have jeopardized the success of that crew's operational mission, or it might have jeopardized in some way the life of the crew if he had an attack in the aircraft and so on. So G.R. Johnson was so annoyed that he not only relieved him quickly of his duties. Black Mike really, when he went up there, felt that he could appeal to G.R. Johnson to set things up so he could operate out there in the Pacific and bring it out in the open and have the doctors cooperate. Well, they RAF are going to provide the medical services out there. And so it meant going to the RAF medicos, and the RAF wouldn't have anything to do with it. And they were annoyed at the RCF medicos for not having twigged this sooner. So it wasn't a very happy ending to Black Mike's career. Black Mike, in due course, was sent back to Canada and without the fanfare that he perhaps he felt he deserved. I don't think there was any real need for any great fanfare, but he'd done a damn good job. Yeah. But he went back, he felt under a slight cloud because G.O. had borne down on him so heavily. But it was a good thing that it came out, and Roy Salmon was then designated to be the commander in place of the of the Air Force element of Tiger Force, RCF element of Tiger Force, in lieu of Mike McEwen.
Now, Reg Lane was going out on that too, wasn't he?
Well, we were all given an opportunity to volunteer for the Tiger Force.
You see,
Reg would be one of the volunteers. I was too. When I had only been back in my new job for a short time when this. We were asked if we were willing to volunteer for our service in the Pacific, and there were posts on that on that headquarters staff out there that I was quite able to fill and anxious to fill. So I put my application in to go. I don't know what my new boss thought about that, but he didn't seem to upset him too much. He was the one who was distributing this info and inviting people to volunteer, so I did.
What did Hester think of that?
I want to answer that question. But let me see. By that time, we're at 45. I had reached an age, if you were beyond a certain age, I've forgotten what the specified age was, you had to go and have an electrocardiogram. Electrocardiograms were in the early stages in those days. We hadn't used them very much in the service, but you had to go and have an electrocardiogram. And I took all the medical that I needed to take right there in the headquarters building mm-hmm. in downtown Ottawa. But to have an electrocardiogram, you had to go out to the hospital area at Rockcliffe. And I said to the MO over the phone, well, you set up an appointment and let me know, and I'll go out. And one day passed, you know, I was keen. One day passed, didn't hear from him. 2 days passed, didn't hear. I phoned back to the chap who was going to set up the appointment. I said, look, he was a senior medical officer. I said, what about this electrocardiogram? Oh, he said, you passed it fine. I said, what do you mean I passed it fine? Oh, he said, I've got the results right here in front of me, right on my desk. He said, your heart's first class, no problem at all. And I said, are you sure? He said, well, have you got any doubts about your heart? And I said, no, none whatsoever. Oh, he said, well, I got it right here, just finished reading it. So I didn't say anything more. But I knew what had happened. I had a namesake on my staff, Group Captain Dunlop. He was in charge of the training director, didn't I? He'd got out of the hospital. He'd taken this electrocardiogram and I put it down under my name, C.R. Dunlop against G.P. Dunlop. So I decided I'd just better let sleeping dogs lie. That was all I needed on my files. But of course, before anybody, Reg Lane, myself, or hundreds of others had an opportunity to make any further move, the war in the Pacific ran down. The bombs were dropped in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And let me see, they were in August, weren't they?
That's right. In August. Yeah.
And by early September, the terms of surrender were signed. So there we are. I guess that's enough for
Yeah, well,
for
I think that's a very good point as a sort of a kickoff for the post-war period.
Yeah.
And that I rather suspect, must have been interesting.
Well, it was, and it was something quite new for me. Not that I was without staff experience. I spent the first 2 years of the war as the director of armament at Air Force headquarters, and was a very, very busy directorate, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But it was a narrow element of staff activity. And I had missed staff college by virtue of the outbreak of war, so I didn't have staff college training. And here I was in a senior staff appointment, responsible for plans and operations and whatnot in the Air Force. I'd had plenty of operational experience, so
that
was the main thing.
Unfortunately,
the fellows who had the staff college training and went through the war without having operational experience were the ones who really lost out in the end, because there was a great deal of weight put on operational experience, both in the RAF and the RCAF, and understandably so. And same in the Army. If you got through the war in the Canadian Army and didn't have a lot of field experience in wartime operations, you had a very severe handicap.
Yeah.
You didn't get.
I think in large measure, Larry, because the people by the end of the war, the people at the top, people like Simmons and Burns and Fowkes and whatnot, the people who were making the decisions on who would be promoted, et cetera, they would go back to their wartime experience. You know,
that's right.
They commanded a division, they commanded a corps, they commanded the large groups, this is really what it was all about. So I imagine they'd get...
I remember Guy Simmons, for example. He was so... This was such an important factor in his mind that on one occasion, when a nominee was made to a tri-service post, which he felt demanded wartime experience, he turned and the officer nominated was an Air Force officer on this particular occasion.
Yeah.
He wouldn't give his okay because that fellow had not had fighting experience in the war. So that's an illustration. I think he was probably quite right. I think it's an illustration of how much importance those chaps placed on that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, there we are, sir.